Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, June 11, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, we're going to review the top stories in money and markets, and then we're going to take one question and ask Catherine, then Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin and myself, some debunking of the Federal Reserve, debunking of conspiracy theories about the Federal Reserve, and then we're going to cover our movie, Other People's Money, with Danny DeVito. I hope you got a chance to watch it because it's really funny. Franklin, you with us?
I'm here.
Okay, so I'm going to invite Franklin to join us for Money and Markets because so much of what we're going to talk about tonight, both in Money and Markets and Precious Metals, just weaves in together. My theme for this evening was going to be bond market implosion, but the Treasury auction did well today, so the bond market is holding up, although it's stretched very thin by extraordinary Treasury auctions to finance the deficit. But my theme tonight is the truth is now profitable. And let me start with a comment that was written by Thomas O'Brien in his Tiger Financial News Network report on this Monday, June 8th. I'm reading from Tom O'Brien. What we've just witnessed in the banking structure is going to go down as one of the slickest moves in financial engineering, not only in our lifetime, but in history. I want to bring you back first to the downdraft of January through March. What we had there was destruction of the banking system. They all got caught with their own bad paper. In 2000, they had managed to stick it to the public. This time, they were holding the bag. We had all asset prices at the lowest levels in years, yet the banks and big money couldn't take advantage of it because they were broke. It took all but about 4 months to regroup, put the fear of God into the citizens, put a bunch of money into lobbying Congress, and presto, they have taxpayer money to start the game once again. Last Monday, the banks took in $85 billion in exchange for their paper, stock. A few of the larger ones are going to pay back the TARP money to clear government supervision. What this sets up now, folks, is the next leg down in the markets. What we have now is a banking structure that got money, won't lend it, and now is ready for a buying spree at lower levels. Nothing like it. Privatize the profits, socialize the losses, now come in for the kill once again at lower prices to privatize the profits. The banking structure is now ready to take advantage of lower prices. They had just finished getting all they could from the taxpayers, then took the public, including institutions, to the cleaners at higher prices, worthless paper. Now they are ready for primetime destruction in asset prices to clean up at the bottom and make sure one of the greatest transfers of wealth gets back on their side. So what is Tom O'Brien saying? What Tom O'Brien is saying is over the last year, the banks have gotten an incredible amount of money, recapitalized at the expense of pretty much everyone else. The number I keep reminding everyone of is it took the entire history of the nation from the Revolutionary War till a year ago to run up $12 trillion of debt. And in the last year, a new administration and a Congress and the Federal Reserve have basically given or lent that amount of money to the banks. It's an extraordinary feat of financial engineering. Now that the banks are flush with cash and have raised all the money they want for stocks, what's happened? Well, two things. We have the King Report reporting this morning as follows. Goldman CEO Lloyd Blankfein, speaking in Tel Aviv on Wednesday, said, quote, chances are, quote, the U.S. is not in a real recovery. The recession is likely to be long and protracted, and the recovery will be shallow. The Street quickly surmised that Goldie must be short the stock market. Then we have Bill Gross, the head of PIMCO, one of the largest bond managers in the world, announcing at an investment conference reported widely in the last couple of days, saying that traditional portfolio strategy is not relevant going forward because the past will not be a representative predictor of the future. And in fact, everybody needs to get used to having 301ks, and that's sort of a joke, the idea being our 401ks have taken a permanent drop down in value and it's not going to be recovered, which is why I say the truth is now profitable. on another front, Alan Abelson in Up and Down Wall Street had a column in Barron's, No Bottom in Housing. He reports a study done by T2 Partners on the housing market, and here's what he says. One of the scarier charts in the report, but which we think brings into jarring focus mortgage credit's current perilous condition, lists how much each of the various types of loans is severely underwater, to wit. Now, he's talking about all U.S. mortgages. 73% of option ARMs, 50% of subprime, 45% of Alt-A, and 25% of prime mortgages are in that uncomfortable category. So what is he saying? He's saying, well, I guess, Franklin, what you said during when we were talking earlier about this article, at least 25% of the mortgages in the country are, quote, severely underwater.
Right.
Pretty astonishing. Now, to make matters even more interesting, Fannie Mae wants to accept all appraisal data. They want it submitted electronically. I put that article up in the post, on the blog with a comment saying, uh-oh, there goes the paper trail. Ask yourself, how did canceling the paper trail work for election integrity? So so the games are turning more venal, but the truth is coming out because the banks have the money, and now they're now ready to play games. Now, one of the problems that they do have is that Ron Paul's bill on transparency, the Fed is making the rounds, and more people are beginning to understand the danger of the power of the Federal Reserve and its member banks in the market and the extent to which the financial sector is really sort of a welfare baby that the country and the economy can't afford. One of the unbelievable stories of the week was from Bloomberg. It was all over. It's June 5th. The Federal Reserve intends to hire a veteran lobbyist as it seeks to counter skepticism in Congress about the central role's growing power over the U.S. financial system, people familiar with the matter said. Linda Robertson currently handles government, community, and public affairs at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, and are you ready for this? Headed the Washington lobbying effort of Enron, the energy trading company that has collapsed in 2002 after an accounting scandal. So what we have is the Federal Reserve hiring Enron's top lobbyist to help bolster their credibility. Now, I have no words. I have no words to say, you know, that this shows how out of touch the folks in Washington are. I will take you back to those of you who've read my work on Enron or heard my radio shows. I believed Enron was laundering money coming out that went missing from the federal government during that period. And the fact that the top lobbying office was at Enron was run by somebody who had worked for three different Treasury secretaries and was very much a trusted insider in the Fed and Treasury, you know, to me supports that theory even more. It's astonishing. There was also a very good piece both at La Metropole Cafe and went up on Global Research, both websites that I look to for a lot of good news, called A Tale of Two Diverging Economic Worlds. And what it points out is the long-term trend we've talked about before, but is coming into great clarity now that the banks are flush and are turning around and saying, you know, we can't afford to support the boomers in the style to which they're accustomed, so we're going to cut Medicare, Medicaid, et cetera. We need to rethink Social Security. We've got a problem here. Very good article, Tale of Two Diverging Economic Worlds. We've linked to it on the blog. And basically what it says is the demographics rule, and that you have a series of countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, where you have a young population that's growing. And in Europe and the United States, you have an older population that is maturing and getting much less economically productive and expensive, and that tracks with what we talked about last week. And so the truth, again, is coming out, and it's more profitable. Now, I wanted to point you to a series that I did on the blog, because the question is, America now has a group of, or we now have a financial sector that's 40% of the economy, It still requires a lot of subsidy to keep it going, and the question is, what's the next game? Now, we've talked before about the extent to which that group of people globally circled the globe, and as in the 90s, economies imploded around the world, in Russia, in Eastern Europe, in Asia, they swooped in and picked up assets cheap. So there was a process of asset stripping. I've referred often to Naomi Klein's wonderful book, The Shock Doctrine, which really describes a series of how the process worked in Latin America. You have a group of expensive academics go in, make a lot of recommendations on how to resuscitate an economy in trouble. It justifies a round of privatizing that takes assets out of the public sector and out of communities' hands at below market prices, and makes a group of private investors and corporations very wealthy. It's a little bit like what people have referred to as the economic hit process. Up on the blog, there's a series of blog posts which I strongly recommend to you called Financial Ecosystems Part 1, Part 2, and Part 3 that talk about a participating budgeting process that's going to happen in Chicago's 49th Ward. And just happens to be an area of Chicago that has five large city parks, four of them very expensive real estate on the waterfront. And what I describe is the sort of the players and the people behind this so-called philanthropic effort. And I recommend it to you because we are coming into a cycle of state and local government budgets. The big story, and one we'll talk about more next week, is California. We're watching California now with a budget deficit rising up to as much as $25 billion. We have the Sacramento Bee this week writing an article saying one of the policy options on the table is to simply cancel welfare. And when they say cancel welfare, you're talking about something that for every dollar the state saves, they lose $4 in federal subsidy, and literally hundreds of thousands of families will find themselves out on the street without food. So it's an extraordinary thing to even contemplate in public. Now, what we've got, I talked to a wonderful state representative here in Tennessee just last weekend, and he said, you know, we have a $27 billion budget, and we've gotten $5 billion in stimulus package, of which about $1.2 billion shores up the deficit in the budget. He said, but what are we going to do next year because revenues continue to fall? And so we really have a serious question before us, which is, you know, is the game that got played in Russia, in Eastern Europe, and Latin America about to get played here? And what does that mean to a whole series of services and assets, not the least of which is state and local parks? Because municipalities hold land and other assets that are worth literally trillions of dollars. And my question on the Chicago story is, the 49th Ward of Chicago about to get a rebirth of civic participation, or is it instead being, you know, teed up for the next round of neighborhood leverage buyouts? It's the 49th Ward and its parks in play. So, you know, tremendous things going on. Franklin, I didn't know if there was anything you wanted to comment about.
You know, I think it's interesting, Catherine, that Americans have such a little knowledge and sense of history that they don't appreciate that this has been a battle that's been played out over and over in American history. And, you know, I think especially about Southern statesmen like Thomas Jefferson, John Randolph, John Calhoun, all these people, you know, the banks have not, they didn't just jump up yesterday. They've been around a long time, and the warning has been there throughout American history. In the battle between the Jeffersonian side and the Hamilton side, that if you let these people go crazy, if they're not controlled, then they will take over the whole country. And what we're seeing today is exactly that, where we not only make good their losses, but we bankroll them for the next round of speculation where they're going to make even more money.
Right, and then they take a little bit of money for philanthropic effort and come in to help us cut back. It's amazing on the Chrysler story. We didn't touch on this, but there was a brief moment in time when it looked like the Chrysler deal with Fiat was slowed down. I haven't had a chance to read the lawsuit, but according to the reports, the Department of Justice took the position that national needs should override creditors' rights, which when you think about it is pretty stunning. And we had, I read a whole series of different people in the investment community saying, how dare you simply abrogate creditors' legal rights? Well, in a country where, if you look at what's been going on for the last 10 or 20 years, I kind of feel like saying to these guys, have you noticed that it completely, why did you think that if the government can and the banks can do all the different things they've been doing, essentially engaging in systematic organized crime, why did you think that it somehow wouldn't ultimately knock at your door?
Right.
But we're seeing, whether in Chrysler or the auto companies or in California, a situation where you have three constituencies. You have the creditors / investors, you have the banksters, and then you have the people in other living systems. And essentially, the banksters are saying, you know something? We're more important than the creditors, and we're more important than the people in the living systems. And it's interesting because my bet is when they come in and do whatever they're going to do in places like Chicago, they're going to come in on the theory that they're doing green development and environmentally friendly things. But before then, the question in all these situations is, who's going to get what, the creditors, the banksters, or the people? Now, in California, the polls, Franklin, say again and again that the country does not support bailouts of California. But if you look at California, one option, of course, is for the state to declare bankruptcy. A lot of the citizens of California have municipal bonds. So a lot of the people are, in fact, the creditors. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. But there's no doubt about it that through the bailouts, the banksters have basically put themselves in a position where the worse it gets for the creditors or the people, the more the banks can go on a shopping spree at low prices. And that's why I think what Tom O'Brien said is so important.
Right, but the thing that no one should overlook is that what you've done is you've fundamentally replaced the rule of law with politics, and you have created a situation where every investor is now warned, hey, bonds aren't any better than stocks. Bonds
right.
aren't any better than IOUs of some kind, because when the government finds that it's convenient for them to do away with that bonded indebtedness or that bonded indebtedness, then that's it. Your guarantee is gone.
Right. It's funny. I have, in my network, I have all sorts of wonderful people who are these wonderful peace activists. And I have, of course, I have my Quaker relatives, and they keep complaining to me that the South has lost its mind, that everybody in the South is loading up on ammunition since the election. And they don't, what I try and explain to them is our loading up on ammunition reflects an understanding that the only way our assets can have value is if we can protect them from confiscation. And so loading up on ammunition is not about wanting to shoot anybody or protect ourselves from being shot. It's basically about protecting the price of our assets.
Precisely. Yeah.
Well, but how do we help people understand that in a society where rules are determined by force and the power to use force, that the right to own a gun is really about, among other things, it's about protecting your assets from confiscation, and it's about making sure that a widespread opinion that they can't be confiscated supports a market price.
Catherine, I think without guns ever being used, just the fact that there are 200, 300, 400 million of them out there makes a government that is bent on tyranny, confiscation, lawless activity, scratch its head and say, Maybe we ought to go a little slower with this.
I don't know if you saw this. I had this up on the blog about 2 weeks ago. Montana, this is under the sovereignty question, which I know you spend a lot of time on, Franklin. Montana passed a law saying that if a gun was made in Montana, the federal government did not have jurisdiction.
Mm. Well, I think legally they're certainly right about that.
Right.
But what you're seeing is this: there's going to be a huge backlash. That's just the beginning of it. There's going to be a huge backlash against federal power because people are tired, and they'll get more and more tired when they realize the federal government has no interest in them at all, but rather has interest only in the groups that it serves, like the banks. And there's going to be more and more of a backlash against that. It's just starting now.
Well, think of the proof of that, that the Federal Reserve, to shore up its credibility, hired Enron's lead lobbyist. I mean, it's kind of amazing. It's basically saying your vote doesn't matter. I'll never forget one reporter in the first year that Bush, too, was president. A reporter criticized him for something on a, you know, as they were walking along to some sort of event, and Bush turned to him and he said, "You know, I couldn't give a damn what you think." Anyway, we have in Ask Catherine, we have a question that I really wanted to address. It's called Managing. The title is Managing Media of Exchange, and the person says Media of Exchange is managed by the formula default equals interest plus inflation. In a perfectly managed medium, inflation is zero. In a perfect financial environment, interest is zero. In a perfect society, default is zero. You don't manage an economy by twiddling the interest knob and watching the inflation meter. You do it by watching the default meter and twiddling the interest knob to equal it, knowing the resulting inflation will be zero. Now, I think what this what the questioner was getting at was sort of how you manage the how you print this much paper and keep inflation and hyperinflation from happening. And the comment I wanted to make about this is that in the question, the author is describing the financial side of the balance sheet. They're not describing the asset side of the balance sheet. And that is, let me say it again, you have the financial system and the monetary system, but then you have real people and real living things and real assets. And in fact, if you look at how the slow burn in this country is being managed, what I call the slow burn, or how we're keeping hyperinflation from happening, one of the ways we're doing it is what is called demand destruction. If I can unemploy enough people, I can bring down the cost of labor, and I can so reduce consumption among certain populations that I can lower the trade deficit, and I can keep inflation from taking off too much. And so I would encourage you, when you think about how a political economy is manipulated, that you want to look at both sides of the balance sheet, not just the monetary system, because the dance is really between both sides of the balance sheet. Franklin, I didn't know if you wanted to comment on that.
Well, I think the question is predicated on an insane economy. it's predicated on this insane idea that the government ought to be manipulating the value of the currency and the interest rate and all these other things. Well, you and I both know that means somebody who has a benefit is the one that's going to get control of that lever.
Right.
And the insane thing is that's not the business of government.
Right.
I mean, this is such a fundamental question that's overlooked. The question we need to be addressing is, why did we give a group of private people control over the interest rate and the money supply of the country, which is a much more fundamental question.
Well, Woodrow Wilson explained that. He said we made a mistake. He said, I believe he said that's the worst mistake of his administration.
I'd say that was a great understatement.
Okay, well, precious metals update. Tell us, Franklin, what's happening in the precious metals market? And let's talk about the dollar, too.
Well, you know, the dollar had been undergoing a severe decline. And one of the things that I don't want everyone to miss is that the volatility of the dollar.
Stunning.
It's stunning. You know, where it used to move 10 basis points a day, 15 basis points, 25 basis points was a big, big day. Now it moves 100 basis points. We're talking about...
You have to explain to everybody what a basis point is.
Well, a basis point is a hundredth of a point, and so we're talking about the dollar index going from 82 to 81. We're talking about the, you know, or from 79.5 to 80.
So if a mortgage is at 6% and instead it, the next month it's 7%, that is a change of 100 basis points.
Right, exactly. And it's a huge change in a market that used to be fairly calm and fairly stable. And now we see the dollar going down 100 basis points one day, up 40 another day, down another 50, up 75. It's lunatic. It's
right.
Just, you know, it's lunatic. And the dollar will probably rally. It's about 79.80 today on the dollar index. It'll probably rally up to about 82. I don't think that rally will last very long. The long-term picture is just down, down, down. I mean, there's nothing in a, from a technical standpoint that would make you draw any other conclusion. But in the meantime, the dollar is not the only, but it is certainly one of the determinants of the gold price and the silver price. So if you've got the dollar rallying, you know, that puts a headwind at the very least against gold and silver. I think the dollar probably from, it's about 79.80 today, and it'll probably rally over the next 3 to 4 weeks up to about 82. That'll be the limit of it. It won't.
And, you know, it's really not, it's nowhere near its bottom.
Oh, goodness, no.
Yeah. We've had quite an astonishing, the dollar's performance over the last 18 months is quite astonishing.
Well, I think, you know, I looked, this has been probably 7, 8 years ago, and I looked at the deficits, which were trillions of dollars. And I said, the only way that this can be settled is for the dollar to sink, and then it was probably about 100, the dollar index, is for the dollar index to sink to about 40 to make foreign imports so expensive that Americans can no longer afford them. And I think we're on track to that.
Right.
You know, eventually you'll see the dollar index around 40. It'll be a long, slow process, and the government, of course, the Treasury and the Fed manage that, and they manage it in such a way that it punishes speculators. In other words, they don't want to attract sharks to this blood in the water. So every once in a while they'll engineer a surprise rally. They'll send Geithner over to China, and he'll make
get
an announcement. Yeah, well, you know, we saw that last week when, you know, he makes this gets the Chinese to make this announcement that everything's all right. They're happy to buy U.S. debt.
One of the things I hear, no matter who I talk to, all over the world, and you know, of every walk, talk, background, what people are saying, I don't understand. Prices aren't going down. How can we be in a recession? My food bills up, my transportation bills up, everything's going up. We hear that everywhere.
Right, and that's because the dollar keeps going down.
Right, right.
And you know, the massive inflation that's already been put in has overwhelmed, and I think that was certainly the purpose of it. There's the one thing that I'm convinced that the establishment is afraid of is deflation.
Right.
But by deflation now, I've got that very narrow definition, a decrease in the money supply. And there has been no such thing. We're not anywhere near to that. But as the dollar has gone down, you know, gold and silver were overbought. They had, you know, they had run up to a point where their momentum was failing. You got a little reaction. You got a wave down. And I think what you're seeing is the typical ABC correction where you go down in one wave, that's the bottom of that is A, and then you go up, that's B, and then you go down again, that's C. And we're probably somewhere near the top of B now, with gold about 960 and silver about 1540 or so. And so we may go a little bit higher, but you probably see another push down. And that will represent probably the last chance this summer to jump in on gold and silver. Now,
so if somebody's looking to buy, if they haven't bought yet and they want to buy, so So we're saying the summer is the time.
Right. Your next 2 to 4 weeks, probably, I might be wrong about the timing of that, but next 2 to 4 weeks, the only thing that would contradict that is if gold closed above 983 and at the same time silver closed above 16. If that happens, all bets are off. The correction is over. It's going up, and you would just go in and buy at that point. Whenever you get a simultaneous close over those levels by gold and silver, you don't wait anymore. You go in and buy.
It's, a couple times we've seen it push down hard in the last 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always surprised at sort of the heartbeat at how it comes back. It's coming back stronger than I would have expected during the summer.
Right, and that's what makes me say that this correction will be shallow, and probably the dollar's rally will be short, probably not more than 4 more weeks. Now, if you get gold going down below 920, silver below 1450, that would say, no, it's going to be a more involved thing. But one of the things that you need to sort of throw into this mix is the seasonal pattern. Now, seasonal patterns are not sacrosanct. There's nothing that says that a market can't violate a seasonal pattern, because a seasonal pattern is just an average of the last 30 years or so. And with silver and gold, there's a strong seasonal pattern, as there is with most markets. There's a strong seasonal pattern to bottom in June or even July, and then just very slowly through August start to come up, and then reach a peak in October, late October, early November. So there's the influence of that seasonal pattern that you have to put in there too. And normally, most people go home for the summer. You know, investors sort of say, well, I've got the beach, I've got these
other
things.
I'm not going to think about it anymore.
I'm not going to think about this. I'll come back in August or September, and I'll start putting on positions. And so that's one of the things that's working. Now, here's the one wild card that really worries me, and that is the situation, the financial and monetary situation now is so uncertain that a panic could start any time, and people could say, I don't want dollars anymore. I'm going to run out of dollars. And you could have a run on the dollar. Any number of things could happen like that. So there's a wild card in there, and that's the reason why I say if you see gold and silver go above 983 and 16 simultaneously, forget waiting. You got to get in right then.
Have you been watching Ted Butler's discussion about the commercial shorts? What he's saying is the commercial shorts are at an all-time high in the market. So you've got, essentially 3 to 5 banks with the biggest short positions they've had to date.
Well, but those people count on the manipulation of the market by the government.
Right.
And they're part of that manipulation, too. So maybe they're planning on a raid this summer to drive the price of silver and gold down temporarily. But I'll just say, Catherine, the buying power in the market underneath it.
It's very deep.
Oh, gosh. I couldn't, it would take me an hour to describe to you what it's like where 7 or 8 years ago we were sitting there, hoping and praying that we'd get $5,000 orders. Today we get people we didn't know before come in and buy $100,000, $200,000, $300,000.
Right. It's a complete shift.
Right. And that's what they're doing. They're shifting completely out of paper assets into physical gold and silver.
Right. The other thing is if you look at the press, and if you look at media and you look at the sort of mainstream financial press, they're now communicating that people like the Paulson Hedge Fund are taking big positions in precious metals, that the author of the Black Swan is betting on inflation. So there's much more promotion within the mainstream of precious metals as an investment. Now, of course, they're pushing the ETFs and things that we believe are not necessarily collateralized. But you're seeing what I'm seeing is a much more broad-based interest in coins and things that you never saw even a year ago.
Right.
So there's a credibility that there wasn't. Now,
let me take just a contrary turn to that, too. It takes a whole lot of courage and self-confidence for a person to invest that kind of money in silver and gold.
Right.
Because, for all the fact that there are certain people who are saying, yes, this is a good investment. I think there was some big insurance company last week that took a big position in gold. And made it public. But for all of that, most of the propaganda goes the other way. Most of the advice goes the other way. And so when you get people who, you know, who's swimming upstream that way, then that says something too.
Well, most, many individual investors don't know this. If you're at a brokerage firm or you work with a brokerage platform, in many companies, if that platform doesn't sell that product, you are not allowed to recommend it. Mm. So, in fact, it is a violation of regulations for many financial advisors and investment advisors to recommend to someone that they, in, you know, that they buy coins or they buy digital gold or any of those products.
Mm-hmm.
So they are literally not allowed to recommend that.
Right.
So the handcuffs are on. One of the things we saw, you know, and one of the things that does scare investors is this. We saw the indictments this week of the folks who sponsored the Liberty Dollar. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what happened and what you think it means.
Well, I've read the monetary statutes, and I think that probably the Liberty Dollar folks crossed the line.
Well, first tell us who the Liberty Dollar is. Not everybody
knows.
Well,
okay, I'm sorry. This fellow named Bernard Nothaus started this, and basically what he was offering was a paper currency that was backed by an ounce of gold, and he sold them first for $10 a piece, $10 an ounce. And then when gold got up over, or when silver got up over $10, he was selling $20 units, same ounce of gold, but for $20.
And he had a pretty stiff premium, too.
Oh, it was a huge premium. But the idea was that you could use this with merchants who would accept it, and you could avoid using Federal Reserve notes, which part of it I applaud. But I think if you read the statutes carefully, you'll see that it's not exactly counterfeiting, but he stepped over the line. And I think what it shows, you have to stop and think about this. How big could the Liberty Dollar deal have been?
It's tiny.
Oh, it's nothing. It's piddling. You know, if it was $50 million, I'd be surprised. And it shows the paranoia of the government in favor of the banks. It shows that the government is nothing more than the enforcement arm of the banks to go out and punish these people, to punish anyone who dares to go into competition.
Well, let's face it, in a lawful country, what normally you do, the Department of Justice would just go see these guys and say, look, you really can't call this a dollar, and you have to change these things.
Right.
And then you're back over the line. You don't go see somebody. Of course, if you need their, you know, if you need to balance your budget and you need their silver, then maybe you do.
Right, and if you need to terrorize anybody who might try the same thing.
Right, but I think the banks can't afford any leakage. Let me give you an example. If you woke up tomorrow, Franklin, and you were the governor of California, and you said, look, to balance the deficit, maybe what I ought to do is create a California currency and pay all these bills with California currency. Now, wouldn't that go a long way to solving the deficit problem?
Oh, gosh. Look, Catherine, what you've done is recapitulated history. I want to tell you, now, I've got a whole set of currency, of notes from various times, from the German hyperinflation and so forth. One of the things that I have among that currency is an Arkansas Treasury warrant.
Wow.
Now, what that was during the Depression, and my aunt, my mother's twin sister, was actually paid in these. She was teaching in Arkansas. The school system did not have enough money to pay her.
So they paid scrip.
That's exactly right, and because there was no other way to pay them. And
the states have done that before. They've paid with scrip, and it's been used. It's been traded around like currency.
Right, and I will guarantee you, even though I don't particularly support that idea except in the case of an emergency, it's going to reemerge. And
right.
And California, that idea will be floated in California, and they will not call it currency. They will not even call it scrip. they will call it something like treasury warrants. In other words, this is a promise that the treasury at some time or the other, not specified, will pay you X number of dollars. And, of course, what happens then is that a group of people spring up who will discount those warrants, and they'll take the chance that the state will eventually pay them. And so they'll pay you today 60, 70, 30% of what the warrant, you know, what the face value of the warrant is, on the bet that they will be able to collect the full amount later on.
Well, here's our opportunity, or one of our opportunities, is there have been certain design power, you know, I call them trim tabs or control points in the system. So the banks must have complete control of the currency, and they can't afford any linkage. And so they're not afraid so much of the Liberty dollar, but if the Liberty dollar can exist and competitors develop, they've got what's called leakage. The second thing they can't afford is they can't afford place-based data. They can't afford for people to see how the money works in places, you know, both private and public budgets, in a way that they could start to take back control. They need to be able to spend government money unwisely to support the system, and so they can't afford that kind of leakage. And what's going to happen now as we start to make cuts in the muscle, you know, and California starts to look at literally leaving people without food, what we really need to start looking at is, okay, maybe we need to revisit whether or not these design points can continue the way they are. Because the solutions are going to be to use our own currencies. The solutions are going to be to understand, you know, is to map the financial ecosystem. So I think the opportunity for transformation is going to be to start to shift some of these things where no leakage has been allowed.
Well, I think you're pointing, though, to the checkmate move. You're pointing to the move that will checkmate the bank's control of us and the economy, and that is that we revitalize local economies.
Right.
If we do that, and we do that with a currency that we use ourselves, and I, as you know, I'm no fan of created currencies. I'd rather see that we use gold, silver, and gold. But if we revitalize our local currencies, our local economies, even if we use scrip, that checkmates what they do to us.
Right. It changes everything.
Right. And that represents, as you say, a leakage out of their system, and that is the reason why they went after the Liberty Dollar people and punished them so severely. And they will, you know, they'll literally shoot you. That they won't stop at that. These people, well, you know,
no,
I'm saying that because I've had the SWAT team on my deck.
It's physically, you know, and I think one of the things that's not widely understood is how afraid people in America are. You know, when I remember 10 years ago, you'd always hear people joking and saying, well, it's a free country. And then in about 1995, 96, everybody stopped saying it. And even though they denied there was anything to be afraid of, that's how you knew. One of the things I put out, I get a fair amount of questions during the summer about traveling with gold coins.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have to spend a lot of time on it because I put up some of the critical points up on the blog post. But maybe we could just touch on some of the issues when you travel with gold coins across the national border.
As a matter of fact, I had a customer recently who brought this question to me, and he was going to a South American country, and I said, look, take less than $10,000 worth, put it in your pocket, and when you go up to the check-in area, put it in a little bowl and send it right on through.
With the quarters, nickels, and dimes.
Right. I mean, it's not like they go to Harvard to hire these people who work in it.
No, they're smarter.
Right. So anyway, and just pick it up when you go through. And, you know, I got a call from him after he got back, and he said, you know, no problem.
There are limits in other countries. There are. So it's not just a matter of looking at the U.S. restrictions. If you're traveling to another country, you need to understand what their rules are as well.
Right, exactly. But the best way, I think, is just to put it in your own pocket.
Right.
And $10,000 nowadays is 10 Krugerrands. A Krugerrand, think of it as roughly the size of a silver dollar. So, you know, you can put five in one pocket, five in the other. Your pants will still stay up, and you just throw them in the bowl when you go through.
One of our great subscribers, Franklin, sent me an article called Debunking the Federal Reserve Conspiracy Theories.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, what do you think about this? And, you know, I read the whole thing and I realized, you know, if I wrote a thoughtful, intelligent response to this, it would take me a week. So what I thought we'd do is we'd go through some of them each time we're together.
Mm-hmm.
And then over the next couple months, we will finish debunking the debunking.
Mm.
But I picked off the first three, and let me just read them one by one. And because one thing that I think really, one of my goals for this O'Leary Report is to really help you see the game. And, of course, one of the biggest drains to the average person and household in America is the drain of sort of the Federal Reserve monetary policies and manipulations. And so if we can help you see that game, that's part of the way of getting you there to where you can really not just protect yourself but navigate the system with confidence. Okay, so number one, facts. Yes, the Federal Reserve banks are privately owned, but they are controlled by the publicly appointed Board of Governors. The Federal Reserve banks merely execute the monetary policy choices made by the board. In addition, nearly all the interest the Federal Reserve collects on government bonds is rebated to the Treasury each year, so the government does not pay any net interest to the Fed. Okay, so let's take this one by one. Yes, the Federal Reserve banks are privately owned, so we agree with that. There are 12 private Federal Reserve banks owned by their members, and then he says, but they are controlled by the publicly appointed Board of Governors.
That's not true.
I agree. That's not
even
true.
even within the system. I don't know if you know Walker Todd or not, but Walker worked for 20 years for the Cincinnati Fed. He was a negotiator in the Iranian hostage crisis. There is a rebellion in the Federal Reserve banks. There are three or four of the Federal Reserve banks where the presidents and the upper management are absolutely opposed to what the Federal Reserve Board of Governors is doing. And they go public with it. They've gone public with it. Richmond is one of them, and I think St. Louis is one, and Dallas may be another. But they are absolutely opposed to what the Federal Reserve Board of Governors
has. Right, and very concerned about inflation.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, when the Federal Reserve was created, I can't remember if it was Lindbergh or someone else who said, what you have created is a system of 11 mausoleums and one bank. and really, that the truth is that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York is so
powerful,
much larger in terms of government deposits handled and so forth.
Right. Let me just step back. The New York Fed, ladies and gentlemen, is the depository for the U.S. government. So all federal government accounts are essentially controlled and operated by the New York Fed, which, of course, uses its member banks.
Right, exactly. So the Federal Reserve Board of Governors is window dressing. You know, certainly they have power. I'm not saying that.
Right.
But that's window dressing. They don't control the local banks.
Well, the other thing, there are a couple key points, because there are numerous sort of power points within the system. The Gold Antitrust Action Committee, of which I'm on the board, has been filing FOIAs with both Federal Freedom of Information Act requests for information relating to manipulation and management of the gold market by both Treasury and the Federal Reserve. And I keep explaining to them, I said, you know, they keep sending their FOIA requests to the Board of Governors in Washington. And I keep saying, well, wait a minute, the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which is a Treasury-operated fund, which is managed by the New York Fed, reporting directly to the Secretary, not through the bureaucracy at all. So it's basically a government slush fund with wide authority to intervene in the markets, and is controlled and operated by the New York Fed, and therefore its member banks as well. And this thing is entirely secret and silent. And what I've been saying is, look, you send a FOIA to the Governor of Reserve, the Board of Governors. That has nothing to do with the New York Fed. The Board of Governors will not have jurisdiction. So you have got to send one to the New York Fed, and they keep looking at me like I'm nuts. They have no idea what I'm talking about. Well, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I posted, as did many people on the Internet, the video of the Inspector General of the Board of Governors being, and ladies and gentlemen, if you have not seen this video, it is a must-watch. This very sort of attractive, intelligent, responsible, hardworking inspector general basically says they have no idea where the $7 trillion of loans have gone to bail out the banks. And, moreover, as the inspector general of the Federal Reserve, they don't believe they necessarily have jurisdiction. That's the New York Fed. It is a stunning, stunning omission, especially when you understand how much $7 trillion is. You know, that's almost all the debt we've run up in the entire history of the Republic. So, you know, so...
But I want you to think about what you just said, Catherine.
It's stunning.
You're saying that an employee, a high-ranking employee...
The auditor.
Of the Fed, right. This is not the janitor.
This is the auditor, okay?
And she says, I don't know if we have jurisdiction to do that. And the fact is the jurisdiction is so confused that in 1984, there is, I think it's a Ninth Circuit Court opinion that says the Federal Reserve Banks, for purposes of the Federal Tort Claims Act, is not a government agency. It's a private corporation. Now, the Federal Tort Claims Act has to do with claims against the government. But the point I'm making is you've got a federal court here, an appellate court, that said the Federal Reserve System is private corporations. They're not government agencies.
Right.
And then this woman says, who, for heaven's sakes, you got to figure she'd have to know, right? I mean, well, a high-ranking official like that, you figure she'd have to know. She says, I don't know whether we've got jurisdiction or not.
Well, she said, I don't know where the money went, and I don't know if we have jurisdiction to know. So let's pick the next point. It says that the interest that the Federal Reserve collects on government bonds is rebated to the Treasury each year. Now, I want to step back before we talk about interest, and I want to talk about information. And you've heard me say this before. The head of the MIT Media Lab, Nicholas Negroponte, once said, in an information age, data about money is worth more than money.
Mm-hmm.
The Federal Reserve Banks run the wire systems. I once had a senior DEA agent say to a reporter I was doing research for, he says, let's face it, all the wires are batched and run through the New York Fed. They know where all the drug money is. It had taken about 20 years to figure that out. But and so you're talking about a group of organizations, and I told the story on an earlier Solari report. I once wrote or called the public relations offices of all the member banks and says, who controls your databases and who has access, who manages them, do your members have access to them? And they all wrote back and said, that is confidential information. Now, if you give me that data, if you give Franklin and me that data and give us the power to loan money and determine the rules by which money is loaned in the society, how many years will it take us, Franklin, before we own everything?
Not more than 20. I don't think. I mean, I believe 20 years would be a lot, ample time to do that.
Right. So we're talking about the mother of all insider information.
Well, and if you just knew what the Fed was going to do with the interest rate,
right?
That's enough. Or just the simple power to control the interest rate is the power to control the economy. And so, what is the piddling little bit of interest that you make off the government? Well, of course you can give that back to
right.
them.
Right, so they give that back. What's not said is that the majority of the profit is made, or to be made, is made on inside information and off-balance sheet transactions.
Certainly.
So I've told the story of when the banks were in trouble in the early 90s, Alan Greenspan managed a smartly upward-sloping yield curve, which meant people were borrowing at the Fed window for nothing or almost nothing and turning around and loaning the money back to the government at 550 basis points more. So, for example, that means if you had, if you had $10 billion in the market, you were making, just extraordinary amounts. So on $1 billion, what you're making $50 million a year. Is that right, Frank?
I believe it's $55 billion.
$55 million a year. So it's basically you're setting up a system where anybody who has access to the federal credit, such as a bank or the government-sponsored enterprises, can literally print profits.
Right.
And I assure you, if you gave the American people the ability to print profits and inflate the banks into oblivion, you know, every farmer in America could make a ton of money without any work. Okay, so essentially, the writer of Debunking the Federal Reserve Conspiracy Theory is focused on the formal on balance sheet issues, which is, you know, maybe 1% of the game. Maybe. Okay, facts. No foreigners own any part of the Fed. Most ridiculous thing I ever read. The Federal Reserve banks are owned by their member banks. We are not legally allowed to know what member banks own what percentage. If you look at the ownership structure of the member banks, they're either owned by their significant investment positions by foreigners or by institutional investors who operate as managers for foreigners, and we're not allowed to look through that sort of shield. So the notion that no foreigners own any controlling part of a Federal Reserve Bank is a bunch of bunk. Okay, finally, independent accounting firms conduct full financial audits of the Federal Reserve Bank and the Board of Governors every year. The Fed is also subject to certain types of audits from the Government Accounting Office. For many years until recently, for about 10 years, the Federal Reserve's lead auditor was Pricewaterhouse, who was also the lead auditor for FHA, in no small part thanks to me when I was FHA commissioner. They were also the auditor for a lot of the big mortgage bubble players, including Freddie Mac and the Federal Housing Finance Board. What I will tell you, they were also, I should mention, the London branch of Pricewaterhouse was the auditor for the BCCI bank. What I will tell you, having worked very intimately with Pricewaterhouse in a variety of situations, is when I see their name on an audit, what it tells me is the numbers are meaningless. Period, end of discussion. You know, they're part of a syndicate, and their job is to basically ensure that the average person believes that the system is credible. But in terms of real lawfulness or real assurance that the numbers are what they say they are, it's not a name you can trust. And you know, 10 years ago, it was very hard for people to believe that. When I said it, I think today, given what's happened in the mortgage market, the signs of collateral fraud, everything else, you know, that's not a surprise. So independent accounting firms aren't independent. In fact, they're owned and controlled by the same people who own the member banks. So before we close on the federal debunking the federal conspiracy theories, anything else you want to add, Franklin?
Well, just one thing, you know, you're talking about Pricewaterhouse. There's an old Latin proverb, quis custodi et custodes ipsos, who will guard the guards themselves.
Right.
And you said this to me a number of years ago, and I've remembered it ever since. We have entered an age when the most important thing when you have a relation with anybody, especially a business relation, is knowing that you can live and die by their word. And if you can't, then you can't do business with them. And
right.
The fact is that entire system is corrupt.
Right.
And so their word's no good. It doesn't do me any good to see the Pricewaterhouse signature there because it's meaningless.
Right. I'm always astonished when somebody says I bank there because I get, you know, this bank was going to give me 3.1% interest and I can get 3.2 over here. Because, in fact, the question is, who can you trust when things get rough?
Right.
And those relationships take many years. I was just talking to somebody today who ran into all sorts of trouble, nothing to do with them, just in the environment, and they had a longstanding relationship with a great banker. No problem. They figured everything out, got it fixed, but that was because there was a relationship.
Right.
So, you know, it's very, very important in this environment to do business with ethical people. And if you're trading with a firm that's a major member bank of the New York Fed, please don't complain to us.
When they take your money.
Anyway, so that takes us on to our movie of the week, Other People's Money. If you haven't seen it, I really hope you do, because you get to see some of the issues. I won't describe the plot in all of its detail, but it's a story of a company in New England, New England Wire and Cable, that finds itself in a shrinking market as globalization occurs and business moves abroad. And it is has tremendous amounts of cash. It hasn't stayed current. It hasn't modernized. And sure enough, Danny DeVito, who's playing the head of Garfield Investments, whose nickname is Larry the Liquidator, comes in and tries to do a takeover of the company. The CEO of the company is Gregory Peck, and Gregory Peck decides the only honorable way to decide this is to let Larry and himself put the case to the shareholders and see which one the shareholders support, and shareholders is the owner of the company. So Gregory Peck stands up and talks about how important it is to build infrastructure in America and build good companies. And Larry the Liquidator basically says everything's moving to Asia. This company's dead, and everybody needs to sell now, get their money, and do something else with it. And sure enough, the shareholders vote for Larry the Liquidator and to sell. Interestingly enough, the attorney representing New England Wire and Cable is the stepdaughter of the character played by Gregory Peck, who realizes that there are two arguments to this, because one group of people is making the argument of what it takes to build and grow a company and a community, and the other person is talking about what the capital cost of capital is globally and how do you stay current in a world that's moving faster. And so what the attorney does is realize, well, you know, there's some merit to what Larry the Liquidator is saying. We need to modernize. And so she approaches a group of Japanese investors who need to manufacture airbags in America. And after Larry wins the shareholder vote, the employees make an offer to Garfield Investments to buy the plan out so that they can modernize and build the airbags instead of the wire and cable. And so you see a lot of what's called creative destruction that happens in the economic process. There's a whole story underneath the story that doesn't get told. And that is, if you go back and you look at the process of companies like this being liquidated, there are a couple of plots that aren't shown in the movie. One is that the leadership in America and of the sort of G8 globally made a decision in the early, probably the late 70s, that they were going to deindustrialize America and move the manufacturing capacity abroad. And that was not just an economic decision. There were many times that was done and happened where it was not economic to shift it. It was economic for the people who shifted it, but it wasn't economic for the whole. That's number one. The second thing it doesn't say is that it very well may be possible in many of these circumstances that Larry the Liquidator is financing his stock purchases and his takeover with money made selling drugs into the community that he's basically trying to liquidate. And in fact, one of the things that has run expenses up for the company and the community is the expenses that comes from Larry and his investment syndicates operating in dirty ways in that community. So there's a subplot that isn't told, but it certainly describes the dynamic of the fact that the world is changing, communities and companies have to change, there's hot money that wants to do things, and as we're seeing in the 49th Ward in Chicago, you know, there's a lot of big money moving in, there are assets on the table, and how are we going to come up with a more productive and long-lasting transformation than what would happen if we just left it to Larry the Liquidator. So Larry the Liquidator is moving in on our communities and probably on our state parks. We'll stay tuned. Before we call it a night, anything else, Franklin, that you'd like to add?
You know, Catherine, I look around me in amazement, and I'm amazed at the cluelessness of the of the people who are supposed to be the experts this morning on National Public Radio on what's the show, the economic show. Anyway, they had this commentator on, and he said, "Well, I think you'll look back, and I think you'll see that the end of the recession was in this summer." And then he started talking about the jobless statistics and so forth. And he said, "But the only thing about this recovery is it will be a jobless recovery." I thought about that for a minute. I said, wait, you mean we're going to recover, but nobody will have jobs. So somehow, mysteriously, all those consumers who are now unemployed are going to manage to keep on spending money. And, you know, when you say to your listeners that they need to learn to how to how to navigate the economy. That's the kind of thing I think they need to listen. You know, they need to learn. We're being fed hogwash.
Right, and the other thing is these are syndicates. You know, one of the things I realized as I was talking about the 49th Ward story in Chicago is you're watching a syndicate move in, and many people can't fathom that these folks are acting in concert. And behind the scenes, they're developing plans. And, you know, they've got a plan. They've got a one-year plan. They've got a five-year plan. And it's organized around what makes the money.
Right.
And so part of it is seeing the connections between the different players. And, I think the thing to do is to just keep talking about it. And the other thing I think is important is we're in a period of tremendous change. And to navigate it, we have to stay in a state of amusement. And, you know, I don't think that any of this is funny. I don't think it's funny that people don't have jobs. I don't think it's funny that people have, you know, are looking at cuts in health care. At the same time, I think it's really, really important to not to keep our perspective, because that's what helps you navigate. So a lot of it is just about having some faith that there is a way through, and there is, but it starts with seeing the game. Anyway. Okay, so June 18th, next week, California budget crisis. What can I do? Very well relevant to the folks who live in California, but we're going to try and be talking about it in a template that will help anybody in any state start to think through, well, where's the state and local money in my place, you know, and what does this mean to me? What can I do? The movie we're going to be using is another Gene Hackman favorite, Welcome to Mooseport. It's a story of a president who retires to a small town in Maine and gets sucked into running for mayor against the local owner of the local hardware store. And it's a wonderful example of sort of the national issues versus the local issues. So June 18th, California budget crisis. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, then you need to start one, especially this summer. Anyway, good night and good luck. We look forward to talking to you next week.